Talk Show.
Recorded live.
All right. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Pastor Eli James here, along with Pastor William Fink. This is another installment of Christogenos, and we've been primarily on these Friday night shows, we've been doing the Old Testament, and we're deep into the book of Ezekiel. Ezekiel, up until this point, Bill, I would say, as pretty much in Isaiah, also singled out a lot of different nations for judgment. And the first 27 chapters of Ezekiel have been nothing but judgment against various kingdoms in the world, and many of them being Israelite kingdoms, okay?
Well yes, and they, you know, Israel played the harlot with all the surrounding kingdoms.
Right.
Took a lot of them over. I believe Israel took over, you know, Moab is referred to here, and that's referring mostly to Israelites who dwell in Moab.
Yes.
And the same thing with Ammon and many of the other surrounding
mm-hmm.
nations.
Yes.
And there's clear evidence that Israelites dwelt in all the cities of the Philistines, especially in Ashkelon. And because Israel is playing the harlot, so to speak, with all of these surrounding nations, rather than having pushed them out and remained a separate people, it's only natural that those nations be judged along with Israel.
Right, right. And then, therefore, since many of these Israelites lived in those nations, in and among those nations, they became referred to as by those names. And I think in the case of Ruth, it's the case there weren't even any Moabites left in that territory, so that when the word Moabite is used of Ruth, it's a territorial word, not a racial word. Okay?
Well, right. That occurs often in the scripture.
Right, right. And so we have to pay attention to that because Yahweh's law is that race mixing is forbidden numerous times. In Deuteronomy, it's stated in the books of Ezra and Nehemiah, it's stated, and there's many places in the New Testament, for example, the sin of Balaam is often referred to in the New Testament, hearkening back to the days when the Israelites were committing fornication with non-Israelite tribes, okay?
And anybody that believes that Yahweh would break his word and his law,
right,
and then turn around and
yeah.
be two-faced.
And wink at it, right.
They're absolutely being the devil's advocate.
That's right. He would not wink at anything like that. His law is his law. He does not, for one thing, he does not break his own law, and he doesn't care for it when Israelites break his law.
well, right, but there's clear evidence throughout Scripture that those passages can be interpreted to be geographical references.
Right,
And that's, I tried to make a point of that several weeks ago on a program with Clifton.
Yeah, okay. And so I just have one comment on your show last week with Greg. I think you did Ezekiel 26 and 27.
Yes.
And maybe 25. And I just wanted to say that in Ezekiel 27, because we're beginning to talk here about the kingdom of Tyre, and I think you did an excellent job of explaining that these Tyrians and many Sidonians were actually Israelites under a territorial name.
Well, right, and we'll see that more further in here in Ezekiel 28.
Right. But I'm going to be quoting with chapter 28 when we get to it, Bertrand Comparé's analysis of the cherub in the anointed cherub in verse 14. I want to discuss that at length. But before we do that, while I was doing this research, I came across it's a totally unrelated subject, but I was struck by the fact, you know, because I always have the Paul bashers in the back of my mind. And the things they bash Paul for are sometimes really quite idiotic. And in Psalm 53, here we go. Psalm 53, it's just a six-verse psalm. I'm going to read the whole thing. The fool hath said in his heart, there is no God. Corrupt are they and have done abominable iniquity. There is none that doeth good. God looked down from heaven upon the children of men to see if there were any that did understand, that did seek God. Every one of them is gone back. They are altogether become filthy. There is none that doeth good, no, not one. And as I was reading these verses, I was reminded of Paul, because Paul says exactly the same thing in Romans chapter 3, and the Paul bashers hate him for saying this because it's like saying all white people are evil and there's not a good one among us. Well,
none of us can keep the law to can keep every jot and tittle of the law.
Exactly. That's clearly what this means. Let me just read the rest of these verses, and I'll flip over to Romans. Have the workers of iniquity no knowledge, who eat up my people as they eat bread? They have not called upon God. And the fact is that even today, our Judeo-Christian white Anglo-Saxon pastors are eating up their own people. No doubt about it. Verse 5. There were they in great fear where no fear was, for God hath scattered the bones of him that encampeth against thee. Thou hast put them to shame because God hath despised them. On that the salvation of Israel were come out of Zion. When God bringeth back the captivity of his people, Jacob shall rejoice and Israel shall be glad. Now, this last verse, I have a problem with the expression here, bringeth back the captivity, because that doesn't, the Israelites would not be rejoicing over being brought back into captivity. So there's got to be something wrong with this translation here.
Well, a thorough examination of the prophets would see that Israel was to return to Yahweh.
Okay.
They were put off from the land and from the presence of God. And that, too, is a matter of prophecy. And in 2 Samuel 7:10, we see that Israel was going to be given a permanent home that was not in Palestine.
Right.
And that is repeated in Chronicles, in 1 Chronicles, that promise.
Okay.
So there's two witnesses to that. Now the prophets talk often about the return of Israel, but if we examine the context, it's always the return of Israel to Yahweh. As Hosea says, quoting, putting prophetic words in the mouth of Israel, we will return to our first husband.
Right, okay. Coming back. Okay.
Well, right. So this word epistrepho, it can mean a turn back physically,
okay.
But it can also mean, even as Liddell and Scott have it, to be restored or converted. NA27 has here when God restores his captive people.
Yes.
In other words,
right.
That position of sons that we would have once we accept Yahshua as our Savior.
Because it seems to me that there is a preposition missing when God bringeth back from the captivity his people.
Well, right. Turns to captivity means turning them back to him.
Mm-hmm.
That's the promise of the prophets.
Right.
And we'll see that throughout Ezekiel, and I think we've already seen that throughout Isaiah.
Okay.
I don't have particular passages in my head, but they could be easily located.
Yeah. So there's something, there's something illogical here in verse 6 that the King James translators missed. They obviously missed something here because the Israelites would not be rejoicing about being in captivity. Okay. And that's the way this reads. So there's really something wrong. So you're saying the proper translation would be when God restores from captivity.
Well, yes, in the biblical context, it would be a restoration of those people, or that the conversion of the hearts of those people back to Yahweh.
Yes, okay. Converting back from
because
the
captivity. They've been alienated from him. And that's the Paul's message. Paul isn't telling any of the Israelites he's talking to in any of his letters to go back to Palestine.
Right.
Not one of them.
Right.
There's not one instance. That's just crazy. But he's telling them all to return to Yahweh from whom they were alienated. That's a clear message throughout Paul.
Yes.
As for Isaiah 53.
Oh, okay.
53:1, there is none that doeth good.
Right.
Okay. Now, actually, that idea is found in several places in the Psalms.
Okay.
And Paul's quote, where he quotes that, where he's criticized for that.
Yes.
In Romans chapter 3, verses 10 through 18.
Okay.
Okay. That entire passage comes from Psalms 13, verses 2 and 3. In the Septuagint. It would be Psalm 13:3 in the Masoretic text, but it's missing in the Masoretic text.
It's missing from the Masoretic.
So we have to go to Psalm 14 in the Septuagint, which is the equivalent of Psalm 13 in the King James.
Okay.
And we would see that Paul was quoting verbatim from the Septuagint. The
okay.
entire quote from Romans 3:10
yeah.
through 3:18 comes right from Psalm 14:3 in the Septuagint.
Right. So Paul bashers incorrectly criticize Paul as being anti-white, okay, or anti-true Israel in these passages, when he's simply acknowledging the fact that from God's perspective, we are all sinners.
Well yes, every
yes.
one of us. And it's the Paul bashers that are usually self-righteous and refuse to be consistent.
Right, and can do no wrong, right? Except they got Paul all wrong.
The Paul bashers are also, you know, they're also, a lot of them are also, they refuse the law. I mean, John Spong and Joaquin Prince, that they refuse the law. John Spong
right.
is an antinomian.
That's
so
right.
how could an antinomian be a sinner?
Exactly. Right.
An
yeah.
antinomian can't be a sinner.
Because there is no law, according to them. Right.
Well, right. So anything goes.
Yes.
And that's why they
yes.
bash Paul, because Paul consistently tells us that homosexuals and perverts and all sorts of other deviants and evil people won't enter the kingdom of Yahweh.
Yes.
And John Spong marries men to men and says insists that they will.
Yes, okay.
I'd pick Paul anytime over John.
Right. So, in other words, he's quoting verbatim from, you say, Psalms 14 in the Septuagint?
Yeah, it's Psalm 13:3 in the Septuagint, which I think would be 14:3
oh, okay.
in the Masoretic text. I
okay,
get confused.
But that verse is
but
missing.
They're one off from each other, right.
But that verse is missing from the Masoretic?
Yes.
You're saying? Okay.
Yes, and these ideas throughout Romans, you know, 3:10 through 18, these ideas are found elsewhere in the other Psalms.
Right.
Which is why you were led to Psalm 53.
Right.
For this particular passage, right?
Yeah, and it is not a complete quote. It's just two sentences.
Right, but the whole 10 or 12 lines are exact from that Psalm in the Septuagint.
Okay, very interesting.
And the Greek is exact.
So Paul cannot be criticized as making up a new doctrine here. He's quoting this right out of the Old Testament, as he often is. Okay. And he probably quotes more Old Testament scripture. There's probably more Old Testament in the writings of Paul than in all the other books of the New Testament combined.
Right,
he's
except the words
quoted.
Of Christ, who consistently
yeah.
quoted Isaiah
right.
and Deuteronomy. But that there is word for word. There's all you
uh-huh.
know. Paul is half New Testament. Half Old Testament.
Right.
It's incredible how many. Passages.
Yes. Yes. Understood. Okay. So let me read this whole passage here in Romans 3, verses 9 through 20. So, again, because he's brutalized as being an antinomian for some of the statements he makes in here. So while we're on this subject, maybe we can, you know, help clarify this for the listeners. Okay, Romans 3, verse 9 through 20. What then? Are we better than they? No, in no wise, for we have before proved both Judeans and the dispersion.
Well, and Greeks here.
And Greeks, okay. And, of course, meaning Greek Israelites. That they are all under sin, okay. As it is written, there is none righteous, no, not one. As you say, he's directly quoting Psalm 14 from the Septuagint, right? Or Psalm 13?
Well, right. That comes from, I think part of this comes from 14:2, which may be in the King James.
Okay.
But the rest of it comes from 14:3 and or 13:3, and it's verbatim from the Septuagint. The Greek is maybe one or two letters off from the Septuagint.
Okay, okay.
Which are meaningless.
Okay, so verse 11, there is none that understandeth, there is none that seeketh after God, and we have this situation exactly again today. They are all gone out of the way, the great apostasy, right? They are together become unprofitable, there is none that doeth good, no, not when we try. Okay. Verse 13, their throat is an open sepulcher, with their tongues they have used deceit. The poison of asps is under their lips. And, of course, the Paul deifiers, who have made up a new religion around the mistranslations and misinterpretations of Paul, they are definitely using deceit. No doubt
about it. Right. They twisted it into a worship of the Jews.
That's right, right. Judeo-Christianity, yes. Verse 14, whose mouth is full of cursing and bitterness. Their feet are swift to shed blood. Destruction and misery are in their ways, and the way of peace have they not known. There is no fear of God before their eyes.
Because they've justified themselves.
That's right. That's right. They're self-righteous. Verse 19, Now we know that what things soever the law saith, it saith to them who are under the law, that every mouth may be stopped, and all the world may become guilty before God. So, he's saying that if you're not obeying the law, you should become guilty before God. Can you, again, this is, whenever Paul is quoted as speaking about the law, the King James seems to confuse it all. What's really going on here in verse 19?
Now we know that whatever the law says to those in the law, it speaks.
Okay.
That every mouth shall be stopped and all the society will be brought under the judgment of Yahweh.
Okay.
In other words,
under
these people that are clinging to the law, they have to live by it and they're
right.
Found guilty.
Okay.
Because none of us can possibly keep every jot and tittle of the law.
Right.
That's why we had the sacrifices.
Right.
As a symbol in the law to relieve us of guilt and our consciences and as a symbol of the coming forgiveness in Christ.
Yes, yes. Okay, so in other words, we're not talking, he's certainly not saying that the law has been stopped, but what does he mean, that every mouth may be stopped, every lying
mouth? Well, you'll have nothing to say.
Okay.
You'll have nothing to respond. You're a sinner.
Okay, yeah. You won't have any
well, when the
rebuttal.
Day comes that you face your judge, if you're self-righteous, your mouth's
right.
Going to be shut.
And, of course, without the law, there is no possibility of judgment, as he discusses earlier in chapter 3, okay? Therefore, by the deeds of the law, there shall no flesh be justified in his sight, for by the law is the knowledge of sin. So, in other words, since these people keep some of the deeds, and here are we talking deeds of the law, are we talking again rituals? Is this
well,
another?
Well, right. Paul is distinguishing here. The point is to distinguish between the Greeks who are not practicing the rituals and the letter of the law.
Okay.
All right?
Okay.
But understand as they convert to Christianity that their judgment and their salvation are in Yahshua Christ.
Right.
He's contrasting them to the Judeans who are clinging to
okay.
the ways of the law
right.
and demanding that people continue to circumcision because that was a big point of contention in Rome.
Right.
And people don't understand that, but Paul is addressing that contention in Rome at a much earlier time than he addressed it with the Galatians and the Corinthians later on.
Uh-huh.
The answer of the Judaizers.
Right.
It's because of the Judaizers that Claudius, the emperor, really got pissed off and
right.
expelled all the Judeans and everybody practicing Judaism
right.
from Rome.
Right. Now, is that a case of mistaken identity, confusing the Judahite Judeans with the Edomite Judeans?
Well, there was a lot of contention, and he just wanted to end it, so
yeah.
he tossed them all out.
Right. Okay. So there's two ethnic groups coming from Judea, and he doesn't care about
he
the
doesn't
difference.
Care about either one
right.
of them. Except that they're causing a whole lot of trouble.
Right.
One group is causing a whole lot of trouble and agitation.
Yeah.
So he issues a decree, beat it, scram, get
right.
out of my city.
All you Judeans, get out of here. I don't care if you're Judahites or Edomites. You're all out of here. Okay. Right. And, of course, it was the Judeans, Edomites at that time, who were insisting upon circumcision. As you know, and, of course, they still do today. It doesn't. They don't obey the law. I mean, he's talking about Jews here who are circumcised. But who violate the law at every turn.
Well, right, and they were agitating. They
yes.
were agitating the Christians all the time.
Right.
You have to be circumcised. You have to make these observances.
Right.
And the point is in Christianity yes. that, no, we don't.
Yeah.
It's over with. That was Old Testament. That was the Old Covenant. They were symbols of the Old Covenant. Christians need no outward signs. We should obey the moral laws and the Ten Commandments passed down through Christ. And that's all we have to do. If we do that, we can't break the law.
Right.
But all of their all of the little Pharisaical rituals, and like, for instance, on the Sabbath day, you can't travel more than a quarter mile from your house.
Right.
Well, get the hell out of here.
Right.
You know, beat it. Get away from me with that.
Well,
they
even have an exception for that. I don't know if you've, I think we may have once
well,
talked
well,
about
yeah,
that.
Well, yeah, if you can fetch a 9-year-old boy, I'm sure they'll let you go a half mile.
Right. Well, you can get a piece of string. They call an eruv. And if you're attached to this piece of string, you can go as far as the string will let you go, right?
Well, right. And that's so that they don't break that Pharisaical.
Right.
Which is basically, that is not found in the Old Testament.
Yes.
That's not found. It's a decision. It's a decree of the Pharisees, probably in the closing decades of the
right.
You know, the first millennium.
Right. It has nothing to do with the law of Moses. Exactly.
It has nothing to do with the law of Moses. It's a Pharisaical interpretation of the law of Moses
by
which they, at those times, they were the popes of their age. They ruled over their brethren and their subjects as they saw them. With these Pharisaical laws.
Yeah, a lot of ritual and minor observances that must be kept and over and above the moral law, which Jesus directly accused. You have made the law of none effect by your traditions.
Well, right. And if we really look at the Ten Commandments and think about them, we can't break the law in the Old Testament if we adhere to the Ten Commandments.
Right.
And we can't break the laws that matter. To hell with the ritual law.
Right.
Forget about that. It's done. But the laws that matter, about sleeping with other men and
moral laws, yeah.
And sleeping with animals and
right.
Coveting your neighbor's wife and all. You can't break those laws if you obey the Ten Commandments and if you love your brother.
Right.
If you love your brother, you won't be stealing his cattle.
Right, right. That's why the commandment of love incorporates all those other commandments under it. You know, if you're loving your brother, as Jesus said, if you love me, keep my commandments, okay? So there's a direct connection between that kind of love and not violating the commandments, all right? But the Jews, on the other hand, have no love for anybody because they're constantly breaking even their own, you know. They may go through the externals of a ritual, you know, ritual circumcision, but they're not circumcised in the heart, not by any means, because they violate the law constantly, okay? All right, so for those you know who've been listening to us for the first time, when we use the word Jew, we talk about the New Testament Edomites, the Pharisees, and the people who made their own law in opposition to the laws of Yahweh. They
The Jews are basically the people who are the not you are not my sheep people of John chapter 10, right?
Right.
You're not. You don't believe me because you're not my sheep.
Right.
And the Catholic Church teaches that because you're not my sheep, that they teach that you're not my sheep because you don't believe me.
Mm-hmm.
That's what the Catholic Church teaches of the Jews.
Yeah. Well,
that's
in any case, right.
Because Christ said, you don't believe me because you're not my sheep. They were never Israelites.
Right, right.
And those people that rejected Christ were, in essence, never Israel. There were some traditionalists that rejected them.
Right.
Those people had the traditionalists had 40 years to accept him, and then they were judged in the Roman War for the most part.
Right, the traditionalists being the true Judahites that lived in Judea.
Followed the Edomites.
Right, that followed the Edomites. They can be converted back. They can be brought back into
the house. Right, but the people that the Edomites can never be converted because they were never in the first place.
That's right. That's right.
And they are the people from whom today's Jews are in part descended.
That's right.
And his blood is still on them and their children.
Yes. Yes. Okay, very good. All right, so let's get now back into Ezekiel chapter 28. And I believe you and Greg finished all of 27?
Well, yes. And I got a little recap.
Okay, yeah, I promised that I would give you time for a recap. So please go ahead.
You know, last week we had demonstrated through many of the scriptures that the Phoenicians of history were indeed the children of Israel. That Tyre was an Israelite city which was built during the Judges period and which had its own king. We saw in Ezekiel chapter 27 that these Israelite Tyrians had a great international trading system which stretched all throughout the Mediterranean and into the Atlantic Ocean. And here, all of this was lamented by Yahweh through the prophet. It's evident to me that Yahweh has nothing against the world domination of his people, Israel, or against trade itself.
Uh-huh.
However, what Yahweh despises is that when we taste success, we forget him, we depart from his aid, his ways, we fail to be a people, a separate people as he demands, we mingle with the other races, and we see that today. We've seen that in the spread of Catholicism. We've seen it in the English Empire, and it all led to race mixing. Look at the Spanish Empire led right to race mixing.
Right.
Portuguese, the Portuguese sailors were the as white as any other Europeans,
mm-hmm.
but not once they spread into an empire and started bringing the Negroes home to Portugal.
Right, that was bring back the Negro slaves.
It destroyed them.
Right.
It's destroyed us all. And to me, that's the lesson in the history of the Tyrians, and we've failed
okay.
to learn it because we don't know our history.
Okay. All right. Now, is that really that true of the Tyrians? I pronounce it Tyrians, so people...
Well, yes, because they had the Canaanites among them, and they
okay.
developed Canaanite practices.
Right.
They accepted Canaanite Baal worship again.
Okay.
They accepted the bull worship of Egypt. In fact, it was forced on the Israelites.
Okay.
Not so much forced, but it was decreed in Israel
right.
by the first king after Solomon was Jeroboam.
Right.
When the kingdom was split between Jeroboam and Rehoboam, and Jeroboam set up golden calves, and all the
right.
children of Israel, none of them protested. There's no record of a protest against that.
Yes.
He didn't want them going up to the temple to Jerusalem, being afraid that he would lose the 10 parts of the kingdom that he was given. So therefore, he set up these golden calves. Well, all the people of Israel evidently followed right after him.
Right, right. Well, obviously, the kingdom of Tyre was becoming a huge, actually maybe huge isn't the correct word, but very pronounced and important and powerful mercantile empire. Okay.
Well, yes, we have to remember that when Tyre was built, Troy was destroyed.
Okay.
And Tyre really became the gem of the East.
Okay. So it basically took Troy's place on the political map. Okay. But it seems to me the one thing I've gotten out of chapter 27 up to this point was the fact that Tyre is kind of like the ancient world's Babylon in terms of being a almost a world-class commercial enterprise.
Well, definitely, and that's because of the race mixing
uh-huh.
and the acceptance of other races that world trade always
right.
leads us into.
Right.
Where we, instead of respecting the laws of Yahweh our God,
right.
we instead respect mammon and we seek after mammon. And it always works out that when we start seeking after mammon or profit, that we widen our tents to include the other races
right.
in order to increase our profit.
Right, exactly.
That's the way it always works.
To create markets for our goods, right?
That's always what it boils
yes.
down to. And that is the driving force behind the commercial aspect
right.
of Mystery Babylon, and the religious and political aspects of Mystery Babylon
right.
follow the economic.
Okay.
The economic is primary.
Right.
And that's why in Revelation 18 and here, ancient
yes.
Tyre, the main causes given for the judgment are all circled around international trade.
Right. Okay. So I have a two-part question for you in terms of summarizing the kingdom of Tyre and its commercial operations. Number one, to what extent did the Canaanites influence? Were they simply slaves, or were they also involved as moneylenders?
Well, the merchants of Canaan, I mean, Canaan became synonymous with merchants.
Right.
And they were both. They were slaves and they were merchants.
Okay.
And
okay.
I wouldn't doubt if a lot of the settlement and trade with Tyre was prompted and urged on by the Canaanite merchants, just like the British Empire.
Sure. Right.
The British Empire, the expansion of the British Empire
right.
was affected through the money lending of the Jewish merchants of London.
Right. Well, it was Disraeli had the title of the creator of the British Empire.
well, right. And even before that, I mean,
yeah.
in the 1700s, look at the way – in 1600s, look at the way America was settled. I
right.
mean, the Virginia Company, the Hudson Bay Company. Now, a lot of this continent was settled by religious groups, and
right.
that's true. Maryland was Catholic, Rhode Island
right.
And,
right.
and Plymouth Colony – but a lot of it was settled through commercial venture.
Right.
The Carolinas were actually, you know, deeded as a gift by King Charles II upon his restoration to the people that backed him.
Okay.
And those people made a commercial venture out of it.
Right.
So Virginia and the Carolinas were all founded as commercial ventures.
Uh-huh. Okay. And so, our people, typically are people, are religious refugees seeking freedom of religion and freedom of speech. And, they, and in the case of America, they traveled across the Atlantic Ocean seeking these things, right?
But the commerce followed right behind.
But the tyrants follow the religious people and always distort the concept of religious and political freedom with their commerce, international commerce. And hasn't America gone through that same system itself, okay? So, and now the other portion, now since the, what in your, can you summarize, how can you best summarize the case that these Phoenicians were in fact Israelites, and this, and we already conceded that they're paganized Israelites of the Ten
Tribes. Well, right, but
tribes.
Was Yahweh lamenting Canaanites?
Uh-huh.
And how did the prophecies, how were they fulfilled that Israel would be moved to a place, to another place, and from there move no more?
Uh-huh.
How would that be fulfilled?
Right.
If it wasn't through the Tyrian colonization, and the ancient historians say that the Phoenician colonies all came from Tyre and not from Sidon.
Right. Okay. Yeah.
Okay, that Tyre was the launching pad of the Israelite race into the Mediterranean.
And
now, from Tyre came not only the colonies, the Phoenician colonies of the Minoans in Cyprus, okay? The Minoans in Cyprus came from Tyre. The Cilicians and the Carians of Miletus came from Tyre.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of the people who were later considered Greek tribes of Thessaly came from Tyre.
Okay.
Carthage, a lot of the coast of Italy,
uh-huh.
and a lot of the coast of Gaul. When the Ionian Greeks went to Marseille, they supplanted Phoenicians Marseille and basically took that from a weaker colony of Phoenicians, and the river colonies of France and the entire Iberian coast were all Tyrians. They were all Israelites from Tyre.
Yeah. Okay. So they
They extended the tin trade all the way to modern-day Wales.
Yeah. Okay, so follow-up question.
To Cornwall.
And it sounds like what happened in those days was that a Mediterranean-style commercial enterprise with Israelite sailors, probably Israelite sea captains, and Israelite kings, well, probably no queens, but Israelite kings of Tyre, and then Mystery Babylon in the modern world would be began as a transatlantic empire of, you know, with, you know, the British Empire with the American Empire, but behind the scenes, the Rothschilds were pulling the strings.
Well, right, and I'm sure that in the days of Tyre, that there were Canaanite merchants who had some influence.
Okay.
There's little doubt. It can't be proven,
mm-hmm.
but the word Canaanite is synonymous with the word merchant,
trafficker.
And it does appear in those contexts in the prophets.
Yes. Okay. So, and then a follow-up question. How best can you argue against the very, very common false idea that the Phoenicians were not Israelites and were some sort of quote unquote Aryan, non-Semitic Aryans? How do you answer that claim?
Well, you know, they can't deny that the Phoenicians are Aryans.
Yes.
Because everywhere they went, you find Aryans in ancient history and not Semites.
Right.
Okay.
Okay.
But
not Jews, because Semites are really Hebrew Aryans.
Well, right.
Mm-hmm.
Well, when I said Semites in that context, I meant
you
from the
Jews.
Jewish perspective and not from our perspective.
Right.
Like we're talking about the mainstream perspective.
Right.
Everywhere you find Phoenicians, you find Aryan peoples and not what the mainstream perspective would consider to be Semites.
Right.
Now, these people clearly spoke the same language that the Hebrews spoke.
Had the same alphabet.
Paleo-Hebrew. They were also claimed by Josephus to be his people.
Uh-huh.
And Josephus says that, and he quotes in Against Appian, I quoted it last week, he basically says that Tyre was his city, and he gives a quote from the Greek saying that the Tyrians were the only people, and the Syro-Phoenicians, and this is a quote from Herodotus, were the only people in Palestine that were circumcised.
Yeah.
Okay? Now, if you read, when we read this next chapter in Ezekiel, we'll find that the king of Tyre was circumcised.
Okay. Okay.
Now, Josephus the historian says that only the Israelites were circumcised in Palestine.
Right.
In other words, he's denying the circumcision of the other races in Palestine.
Right. So that the Edomite Jews, the Canaanite Jews, only picked up this practice later on, probably when John Hyrcanus made a pact with the Edomites in 125 B.C. That's when history, Josephus records that the Edomites were first time ever circumcised.
Right.
Okay.
Now, last week I gave evidence from several of the prophets, and from 1 Esdras chapter 4, and from several of the prophets, that the Tyrians were indeed Israelites. That Tyre was a Phoenician city. Zebulun and Asher and Naphtali all inherited Tyre, and that's perfectly evident in the Septuagint version of Scripture.
Interesting.
And
there are
many.
Masoretic.
Well, no, there are many passages in the Septuagint that are not in the Masoretic.
I wonder if the so-called Semites who redacted the Masoretic text had an ulterior motive for not including those verses.
Well, I think so, because they knew that it would probably identify the
right.
Yeah, you know, now you're talking about the 5th or 6th centuries A.D., and the cat would be out of the bag.
Right, right.
It's the famous Phoenicians of yore, and the Greeks knew everywhere the Phoenicians went, and the Greeks knew that they in part descended from Phoenicians.
Right. So the people who call themselves Semites today can't let on that the true Semites don't have hooked noses and are actually Aryans.
Well, right. Yeah. And there's many passages in the Septuagint that, beyond a doubt, and they're all in my paper on Christogenia, classical and biblical records identifying the Phoenicians.
Okay.
That there's many passages that make it very clear that Tyre was an Israelite city. And David's census and things that Joseph has said against Appian, and when you put them all together, it's an indictment that's hard to get around. And the mainstream historians, I would challenge any of them.
Right. Okay, yeah. So they've basically swallowed the Jewish claim that they're the Shemites of the Bible when they're, in fact, not.
Well, they swallow that claim, and then they've imagined that if they are, then there's no way the Phoenicians could be Israelites.
That's right.
So they have to be Canaanites.
Yeah.
It's the only other choice.
So
and in truth, the Jews are the Canaanites,
right,
and the Phoenicians were Israel.
Right. And so we're recounting all this history, folks, to explain why the academic world just doesn't understand who the Phoenicians are. And, you know, as you said earlier, they have to assume that the Phoenicians were Aryans and not Shemites, but the Shemites are also Aryans. You know,
right. And and here, the Semites were originally Aryans. They weren't Jews. A lot of people say, oh, the Arabs are Semites. Well, no, they're not, because the word Arab itself means mixed.
Right.
How could they be Semites?
Right, they can't. Well, they're Semites in speech.
Well, then we have a lot of English Negroes running around America.
Right, right. Yeah, so this confusion in terminology is deliberate, and it's very important that we clarify that the Hebrews, Shemites, Aryans, Israelites, Adamites, are all the same race. There's not a Jew in that category. The Jews are, in fact, Canaanites and Edomites primarily, and they're not Shemites at all. They just pretend to be and have the whole world fooled on this count. And that's why these secular and even biblical academics just don't understand the true history of this period. They just don't get it, okay? Because they believe that initial lie that these hook-nosed kikes are Shemites, when they're not. They're Edomites and Canaanites, and as we're discussing right now, the Canaanite being another term for merchant, it became synonymous with merchant, and typically, you know, there's Jewish moneylenders. Whenever there's big-time commerce, there's Jewish middlemen and Jewish moneylenders involved, okay? That's just always the case, all right?
Now, in preparation for last week's show, before I knew you weren't going to be there, right?
Uh-huh.
I had taken the program that we did in March of 2009 entitled The Israelite Phoenicians, and we did that on a Voice of Christian Israel on a Sunday program. And I put that back on the front page of Christogenia, and it's had 630 something downloads.
Uh-huh.
Just
great.
In the last 2 weeks.
Great.
It's probably had, I didn't have a counter on my downloads last year.
Yeah.
And it probably had a lot of downloads then, but
yeah.
It's had 600 and something new downloads since.
Yeah. I got distracted. I just had to block a kike. So that's why I was slow in responding to what you said there. But now with that as, you know, introduction, can we go into Ezekiel chapter 28?
Well, I got a little more introduction.
Oh, you got a little more. Okay.
You know, I did screw up last week. I erred when I said that Tyre had never been built upon since it was destroyed.
Okay.
And you know, most of my reading is old books, right? So I don't. The modern world sometimes confuses me. Yet, you know, today there are buildings which are apparently on the site of the old city, and all of these buildings are rather recent. And Tyre did sit vacant for many, many centuries. And I think that today it's built up again for a reason, and that reason is found in Malachi 1:4.
Okay.
Whereas Edom saith, these Jews in Palestine and a lot of these Lebanese and these Arabs are descendants of the Edomites and Canaanites themselves. And you know, besides,
yeah,
just simply the Jews. Whereas Edom saith, we are impoverished, but we will return and build the desolate places.
Okay.
Thus says Yahweh of hosts, they shall build, but I will throw it down.
Okay.
And they
okay.
shall call them the border of wickedness and the people against whom Yahweh has indignation forever. And I think that prophecy is being fulfilled
right.
since 1948.
Yes. Oh, for, no doubt. No doubt. They have rebuilt. Well, to what extent have they rebuilt Tyre? Because
there are buildings all over the place. There are buildings that they filled. It looks like they pushed a lot of sand out into the sea and probably filled it all in again. And,
okay.
and that there are
the
buildings
landfill.
All over the place.
Yeah.
Yes.
But have they actually built on the island that Alexander
built
the causeway to?
That there's a projection that looks like it was at least maybe part of the island, but it's hard to tell.
Okay.
Because we don't have any satellite pictures of the ancient island, right?
Right. Yeah. Okay. So to some extent they have tried to rebuild Tyre, but even there they're certainly not trying to rebuild Tyre. They're part of Mystery Babylon, claiming to be the Israelites of the Bible, and that's how they lay claim to.
Well, right, but even the Lebanese of today, they lay claim to be the original Phoenicians.
Okay.
They make that claim for themselves.
Okay.
It's all over their books. I bought a book a few years ago
okay.
On the ancient Phoenicians, and it did real good with the archaeology, and you could see all these ancient Phoenicians are clearly
okay.
white,
well,
right?
And
he
right.
did right by connecting the ancient Minoans to the Phoenicians. He did a lot of good work in the book, but he's a Lebanese that claims that the Lebanese are the Phoenicians of old, just like the Jews claim that they're the Israelites of old.
Right.
And they're all Canaanites.
Right.
Just like these Egyptians, Egypt today is called the Arab Republic of Egypt.
Right.
It's called that for a reason.
Right.
But they still claim that they're the original Egyptians and the ancient Egyptians look just like them.
Right. Well, yeah, we know that's not true because Mr. Hawass has been trying to prevent all of these white mummies from having their DNA analyzed. And, of course, recently King Tut's DNA was analyzed, and he was shown to be 95% white, okay? From what DNA they could recover, 95% of it was white, okay, and not hook-nosed kike. And not
well, I would say in his case, he was clearly part Hittite, and the 5% was probably
Hittite. Okay, all right.
Well, historically, he descended from Hittite Egyptian mixed marriages.
Uh-huh. Okay. Very good. So brings to mind a question. What is the distinction between the Philistines, which I can see that the modern day inhabitants of Lebanon might be related more to the Philistines than to the Phoenicians?
Well, no, because the Philistines were first the Philistines had Kenite mercenaries and Rephaim mercenaries among them.
Okay.
There's no doubt that's part of the scriptural record.
Yes.
Goliath and his brothers were Rephaim.
Okay.
They were descendants of the giants. They were descendants of Wrath of the giant. It's very clear and spelled out right in Chronicles, and it's spelled out in the Hebrew language
in
the account in Samuel. Now, the Philistines themselves, according to Scripture, come from Mitzrayim. They were a settlement of colonists at one time who came from Egypt, and of course the ties broke over the centuries.
Yeah.
And at one time they were competitors with Egypt, and we see that with America and Germany and America and England today. It's very easy to happen.
Right.
Over centuries. Now the Philistines, even up to Zechariah's time, must have been fairly racially sound, because in Zechariah it is a prophecy. A bastard shall live in Ashdod.
Okay.
Ashdod being one of the principal Philistine cities.
Yes.
If Zechariah is saying, future tense, a bastard shall live in Ashdod, that fully indicates to me that bastards did not live in Ashdod when Zechariah wrote that.
Okay, so if they're Mitzrayim, that means they were descendants of Ham.
Well, right. And there's another prophecy of Israel, and we read it in Isaiah, they shall fly on the ships of the Philistines to the west, speaking of Israel. So we see that the Israelites, the Israelites and the Philistines did have a lot of joint trading and merchandising and commercial contracts, which are pretty clear in the Bible and history, that they did operate together in that manner. And we see in Dor. Dor was a Philistine city at one time, and the Israelites took it over. There are all kinds of book of archaeological evidence from both groups in that region.
Yes. Okay. Since we're on this, one more follow-up question. Was there any intercourse between, I'm talking about economic and social intercourse between the Philistines and the Phoenicians, or are those two entirely different eras?
No, there had to be a lot of intercourse between them.
Okay.
There had to be. The Philistines, the Israelites of the northern tribes. A lot of people, especially the people that draw Bible maps, right?
Yes.
The people that draw Bible maps, they'll draw a circular area in the middle of Palestine away from the coasts and say that's where the Israelites were.
Mm-hmm.
And then they'll draw these regions on the coast and say this is where the Canaanites were.
Yes.
But when we go to Deborah, the Song of Deborah in Judges chapter 5, I think it's chapter 5, we'll see very clearly that she states, why did Dan remain in ships? Now, you can't get to the ships from the middle of the mountains, right?
Yes.
I mean, you had to be along the coast to get to your ships, right? Why did Dan remain in ships? And then she says, Asher abode in his breeches.
Uh-huh.
And that's a word that means inlets or harbors. Okay?
Okay.
So it's very clear, right from the scriptural record, that the Israelites did occupy the coast of Palestine, and therefore Asher did occupy the coastal cities that he inherited.
Right. Okay. Yes. Very good. Okay. Before, the chat room is really... alive with comments. I had to block one individual, but one person quoted the really famous statement by Paul that there's no Jews or Gentiles, there's no male or female, he quoted it verbatim.
Yeah, right. All Israelites are equal in the eyes of God.
Right. Israel.
And that's what Paul's saying there. All Israelites are equal in the eyes of God. There are no Judean Israelites or Greek Israelites.
Right.
There are no circumcised Israelites or uncircumcised. In other words, it doesn't matter. The distinctions between Israelites doesn't matter as long as they're all Israelites, because they're the people Paul was writing to.
Right. And, of course, the Gentile or the Greek we're talking about were, in fact, Greek Israelites of the Greco-Roman world. Those were the nations that the dispersed Israelites founded.
Josephus makes a statement that if it weren't – he basically says, and I'm paraphrasing, right? But this can be borne out, and it's very clear, that the only way to tell the difference between Judeans and Greeks was circumcision.
Okay. Yes. Okay. So the Judeans incorrectly translated as Jew, because in the Greek it should be Judean, which means resident or citizen of the country of Judea.
Well, which we see in
right.
And it's fully evident in history that had become a polyglot and miniature empire.
Right.
It was a mixed race region. It had Edomites in it. It had Canaanites in it.
Yeah.
It had Samaritans in it who were of 19 different tribes or 20 last I counted.
Yeah.
And it had true Judeans in it.
Okay. So in modern terminology, we could be quoting, paraphrasing by saying there is neither American nor European.
Well, there's not, right, neither
we're talking exclusively
Yankee
about
or
white people.
There's neither Yankee or Englishman. You're all white.
Right, exactly. Exactly. That's what Paul is saying. He's not saying there's no difference between hook-nosed kikes and Greeks. There's a huge difference between hook-nosed kikes and Greeks. Judeans and Greeks. They're the same race.
Paul excluded the Edomites of Judea. He said that they were vessels of destruction.
Right.
And he told us time and again not to have any dealings with them.
And he excluded the Ishmaelites. So the this cannot be generalized beyond the Israelite world, the Greco-Roman Israelite world. And, I found a quote here. There is neither bond nor free. Well, of course, this is all symbolic. It's not literal because the people in slavery were still being enslaved, and the people who were free were still not slaves, right?
Right.
So he's talking about he's not saying that those differences don't exist. What he's saying is it doesn't matter in terms of whether you have been forgiven at the cross. That's what. Now the Jews, the Edomite Jews, were not forgiven at the cross, were they?
No, absolutely. There's no reason.
Right.
There's no context.
They're the ones who killed them.
The only biblical context for anybody to be forgiven is Israel. Nobody else can be forgiven.
And certainly there are male and female Israelites, you know, so this can't be taken literally. It's symbolic language. What Paul is saying is that your forgiveness at the cross is not dependent upon whether you were circumcised or uncircumcised, free or bond, male or female. None of that matters. What matters is whether you are an Israelite of the covenant, then you were forgiven. Right? Isn't that what Paul is really saying there?
Absolutely.
Yeah, he's not saying that there's no difference between Jews and Greeks.
There's certainly a difference between Jews and Greeks.
Right.
Well, maybe that's gone today.
Yeah. And the context is simply, you know, the forgiveness at the cross. Okay? He's not making a blanket statement that there's no difference, physically or spiritually or ethically between Jews and Greeks. Of course, there's major differences. And the Jews have already been condemned. How could they be condemned beforehand? The scriptures clearly say that if there's no difference. Okay? So it's symbolic. It's metaphorical. Okay. Now, can we get to...
Well, before we get to Ezekiel 28,
okay.
I got a couple of paragraphs about the king is God.
Yes.
Right? Because they in the ancient world, many kings elevated themselves to the position of God.
Okay.
And they actually
had...
They actually had life and death, the power of life and death over their subjects. And
right.
In fact, the Caesars always kept a dagger in their belt, not as a method of self-defense, because they had guards all around them to defend them, right?
Yeah.
It was usually their mothers that poisoned them, and that's how they died. It's that they kept this dagger as a symbol of the power of life and death over the people of Rome.
Yeah.
Now, the king is God. I'm going to quote from the story of Sinuhi. This is from ancient Near Eastern texts relating to the Old Testament, page 19, and it's speaking of the Pharaoh of Egypt at that time. Moreover, he is a god without peer. There is none other who surpasses him. And 500 years later, I'm going to quote now from an inscription from the Pharaoh Amenhotep II, who may have been the Pharaoh of the Exodus. He was one of the Thutmose's clan, right?
Mm-hmm.
Quote, now when the prince of Naharan, the prince of the Hatti, and the prince of Shinar heard of the great victory which I, Amenhotep II,
yes,
had made, each one vied with his fellow in making an offering, while they said in their hearts to the father of their fathers, in order to beg peace from his majesty, meaning Amenhotep II,
yes,
seeking that there may be given to them the breath of life. We are under thy sway, for thy palace, O son of Re, Amenhotep, the god ruler of Heliopolis, ruler of rulers, raging lion in this land forever. So he gives himself the title,
right?
Son of Re, which is the sun.
Mm.
Okay, and the sun was seen as the symbol of God in the ancient world.
Right, right.
Amenhotep, the god ruler of the city of the sun, is what he's calling himself. And that's, they elevated themselves, the pharaohs did, to the position of gods.
Yeah.
Now, even the Hittites, the Egyptians, they all saw themselves also as the incarnation of the sun on earth.
Uh-huh.
Of God on earth.
Yes, okay.
Now, this assertion of the conqueror king to be God manifested itself again. This assertion manifested itself again in Imperial Rome at the time of Christ. We must remember that first, the old Roman Republic was founded on democratic principles.
Right.
That the Roman people would decide the fate of the nation. And kingship, they had thrown off a kingship in the 5th century B.C. Kingship was seen as tyranny. And it was defeated and rejected by the people of Rome 5 centuries before Caesar,
right,
in the 6th century B.C. When Julius Caesar achieved his military victories, he began to act with little deference towards the Roman state, and his ego began to alienate the Senate. But in turn, the Roman Senate continued to heap plaudits upon him. So they made games celebrating his victories. And he was honored with the right to wear triumphal clothing, purple robes, crowns on all public occasions. Now the purple robe is reminiscent of the ancient kings of Rome.
Uh-huh.
And that tradition carried itself to Rome with the Israelites of the tribe of Judah from the east.
Okay.
Okay, because that's where they came from, right from Troy. And they wore that purple as the sign of rulership. Well, Julius Caesar started it again.
Right.
He started wearing purple in Rome after like a 500-year absence. Now, normally all Roman men wore plain white togas. You couldn't wear a different color. You couldn't say, I'm going to wear a green toga today. You're making yourself special. It's off with the head.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you know, you had to be colors and decorations on one's clothing were symbols of status which could be granted by the state alone.
Right.
If you didn't have any special decree or sign of authority or office, you wore a plain white toga, and most Roman men wore nothing but plain white togas.
Right.
Okay. Now, a large estate was built at Rome's expense on state property for Caesar's exclusive use, and that's, you know, these are all worldly things that have been given to him as a reward for these conquests. However, the title Imperator was made a legal title that he was able to use for the rest of his life. And that was shortened by Brutus, right?
Yes.
An ivory statue was made in the likeness of Caesar, and it was carried at all public religious processions. Tell me that doesn't sound like the Catholic Church. Another statue of Caesar was placed in the temple of Quirinus with the inscription, to the invincible God.
Right.
Okay? This is Julius Caesar. Now, Quirinus was the deified likeness of the city's mythical founder and first king, Romulus. Okay? So Caesar really triumphed in his victory battles, in his imperial victory battles, he really triumphed over the Roman state itself. And we see in this country the same pattern. When we went to an imperialistic foreign policy, our presidents and our leaders became tyrants rather than servants of the people.
Right.
It's the same pattern all over again.
Exactly.
Now this act of setting this statue up in the temple of Quirinus with the inscription to the invincible God clearly identified Caesar not only on equal terms with the divine,
right,
but also equated him with the ancient kings. And that was a clear sign of the end of the Roman Republic.
Right.
And Augustus and Antony, Mark Antony, each eventually followed suit, and each of them adopted that title Quirinus for themselves later on. Now, Caesar did another thing that was unheard of. He had coins minted bearing his own likeness. And this was the first time in Roman history that a living Roman was portrayed on a coin, which clearly placed that living Roman above the Roman state and all of its history and tradition. So from that time forth, all of the Caesars would be worshipped as gods.
Yeah.
And many of them even demanded as much. And we see that the revolt in Rome first, and I'm sorry, in Judea, in Jerusalem, first started when one of the Caesars, I think it was Nero, wanted to put a likeness of himself in a temple in Judea.
Uh-huh.
That's how it began.
Yeah.
That he wanted to be worshipped as a god by the Judeans as well as by everybody else in Rome. That became, from the time of Caesar, we saw a cult of Caesar arise in Rome right alongside all of the pagan cults, and the Caesars would be worshipped as gods.
Yes, yes.
So we have, again, the king as god.
Right.
And we see that in ancient Egypt with the ancient Hittites, with the ancient Babylonians,
right,
and many other places in the ancient world where the kings elevated themselves to the position of God.
Yes.
And we see it in the Catholic popes, too.
That's right.
Where they politically corrected it a little bit and demanded to be worshipped as replacements for God,
right,
the vicarious filii Dei, the replacement for God on earth or for the Son of God.
Right.
But so that when we read, you know, in here in Ezekiel 28, that the king of Tyre would be, you know, set himself up as a god. We're not seeing anything novel. We're seeing something that often occurred in the ancient world, and clearly Yahweh despises it.
Yes, yeah, and clearly the priesthoods, the Jewish priesthood and the Catholic priesthood, have elevated themselves up to the level of God. Okay.
Well, yes, they have.
Yes, they have. Okay.
Well, in Judaism, the decisions of the rabbis in the Talmud carry greater weight than the words of the Torah.
That's right. The words of Moses. Exactly. It says that explicitly in the Talmud, and the Catholic Church says that too. That the popes and their priests can make up their own rules and regulations, which
overrule
God.
The papal bulls.
Yeah, that's right. Infallibility. It's all papal bull.
Yes, it is.
Right. Okay. All right. Speaking of papal bull, shall we go into Ezekiel chapter 28?
Well, yeah, we could finally get to Ezekiel 28.
Yeah. Okay, very good. I don't think we're going to get very far in Ezekiel 28, but let's give it a shot. Okay. The word of Yahweh came again to me, saying, Son of Man. Okay, now this expression, Son of Man, this occurs a lot in the New Testament. And Yahshua...
Well, we're all sons of Adam, right?
Right.
And that's the phrase here. But Yahshua Christ was Yahweh himself manifest as a man.
Okay.
And he called himself by the term Son of Man. I think that was a self-denigrating and self-humbling term that he used of himself. Because, as Paul said, he was much higher than the angels, but
right,
made himself a little lower than the angels for our sakes.
Right. He came to serve. He came
to
serve us, not to dictate to us, but to serve us. Obviously.
Well, yes, but his calling himself the Son of Man was actually an act of self-humiliation, of self-debasement.
Right. But he also says in the book of Revelation and elsewhere, I am the root and the offspring of David.
Well, right. So, he's the root because he's the creator.
Right.
And he's the offspring because he's also a son.
So he's both are equal in the fact that he was a human being or a Adamite being, okay? And
right. Paul also said in another place that he came so that he would be the firstborn. He could only be the firstborn by being Yahweh.
Right.
But to be like us, to be made like us, he would be the firstborn of many brethren.
Yeah.
He would be our equal and our God.
And he says in John, I call you friend. Okay, which is, you know, speaking to us, which is quite, humbling for us to have Yahweh in the flesh calling us friend. Of course, he's not our friend if we don't obey his law and try to overrule him, right? Okay, can't be a friend to Yahweh that way, okay? Son of man, say to the prince of Tyrus, thus says Yahweh Elohim, because your heart is lifted up, and you have said, I am a god, I sit in the seat of God in the midst of the seas, yet you are a man and not God, though you set your heart as the heart of God. Okay, obviously very symbolic, you know, talking as you just discussed, men sitting as kings, and of course priests as well, sitting in thrones, elevating themselves and actually believing themselves to be greater than Yahweh.
The Greeks, we have a huge hole in Greek history.
Okay.
We have a 400-year, 500-year hole in Greek history. And they talk about the overthrow of the tyrants.
Okay.
And then Greek history, it basically leaves off at the Trojan War, 1180 B.C.
All right.
And it picks up with the Persian Wars and maybe around the Battle of Marathon around 480 B.C.
Okay, so in between was the Phoenicians?
In between was the king, what were the kingdom years of
the Tyre.
The Israelites and the golden age of Tyre.
Tyre. So it sounds like the word tyrant actually comes from Tyre.
well, you know something? It might.
Yeah.
Tyrannus. And Tyrus are very close, right?
Yes.
It's very possible.
Yes.
However, I believe that we have that black hole in history because the Greeks wanted, and it's a matter of prophecy that Israel would forget who they were.
Right.
That the Greeks wanted to forget being ruled over by the Tyrians.
Okay. So
I think they were ruled over by the Tyrians.
We don't record our in the ancient world their defeats were not recorded as well as their victories.
Well, you know something? There's an invaluable book, a guy named Menander of Ephesus translated the Tyrian archives into Greek.
Yeah.
And that would have read the Tyrian Chronicles, the Chronicles of the Kings of Tyre.
Okay.
And Josephus quoted from them. But he only quoted little bits and pieces, and they're gone.
Huh.
That would be, to me, that would be the book to find.
Right.
But we don't have it.
Yeah.
The Chronicles of Tyre.
Okay. Yeah, interesting. Very interesting. Okay. Well, we'll see. But I think, you know, we're definitely on the right track here, and you're suggesting that the hiatus in Greek history is due to the fact that the Kingdom of Tyre and the Phoenicians ruled during that time.
Well, right.
Okay.
Thebes in Greece is a Phoenician city. It's a famous city. And it was during the glory age of Greece, Thebes was a third. Yeah, you know, it was in third place behind Athens and Sparta.
Okay.
You know, it was diminished as a power. But they actually defeated the Spartans in the major battle that Xenophon recorded after the Peloponnesian was about 380 B.C., And they had a little a short shining light period again, you know, where they had the hegemony for a few years until the Philip of Macedon's time, and they lost it. But the Thessalians were primarily descended from Phoenicians, from Phoenician colonies. That there were a lot of Phoenicians in Greece. There were a lot of Phoenicians in the later area called Ionia. Was primarily still it was ruled by Ionians for a long time, but it was still primarily Phoenician in its racial characteristics and in its customs. The most famous the first famous philosopher of ancient Greece was Thales of Miletus, and Herodotus says he's a Phoenician by race.
Okay, so he was an Israelite.
So the Phoenicians had a tremendous impact on Greek culture, on Greek language. And on the Greek race itself.
Okay. So in other words, there's kind of an element of shame, you're saying, from the Greeks in the fact that they were being domineered over by the Phoenicians.
I certainly believe so.
Okay.
Now the Dorians, I believe, came from Manasseh primarily.
Okay.
Because Dor is a city in Manasseh.
All right.
And the Dorian conquest happens about 1100 B.C., just before the time of King Saul. Okay.
Yeah.
And Homer records the Dorians in the Trojan War period, 1180 BC. But he says Homer describes the entire known world that the Greeks knew to exist at the time of the Trojan War, and all Greek writers who follow Homer accept Homer's records as the historical records, not the mythological ones, because we're mixing entertainment and poetry with history.
Right.
They all accept his historical records as being ex arches from the beginning and legitimate.
Okay.
Now, Homer and He only has the Dorians on Crete.
Okay.
He doesn't have them anywhere else. The Dorians did not come from the north. The Dorians invaded the Peloponnesus by the sea.
Okay.
They were from Manassa.
Right.
They were from Dor. Their staging area was Crete, and they invaded the Peloponnese at a weak point because the Danann Greeks, who had come from Egypt, had had possession of the Peloponnese.
Yes.
And okay. The Danann Greeks had really expended themselves during the Trojan War
and the
defeat of Troy. And that you know, just like the American Civil War, 500,000 men died on both sides.
Right.
And that, who knows what kind of nation we would have had if those men never died.
Right. Right. Yeah. Yeah.
50, 100, 2, 3, 4 generations out.
Exactly. Exactly.
Well, 2 generations after the Trojan War, the Danans were weak enough that the Dorians came from Dor and just took the Peloponnesus and drove them all out.
Right, yeah.
Or enslaved the ones that weren't driven out. So
yeah.
So now right after that, around that same time, we have the beginning of the Golden Age of Phoenicia, right around the time of the Trojan War.
Okay.
And that's when Tyre begins to project her power throughout the Mediterranean.
Right. Right.
And I believe that they all of the colonies, Phoenician colonies that weren't dominated by Greek tribes, that weren't Greek,
mm-hmm.
right? Because Thessaly came to be dominated by Greeks, even though many Phoenicians settled there.
Right.
And Ionia and Miletus and Caria, even though Strabo says that at the time of the Trojan War, all of those were Phoenician colonies that took their kings from the Trojans,
uh-huh.
which helps to demonstrate the scepter of Judah out there.
Scepter of Judah, yes.
Right.
Yeah. Okay.
After the fall of Troy, they came to be dominated by Greeks. But the Phoenician element, I think, it is the element of tyranny that the Greeks had freed themselves from that is not discussed by the Greeks.
Yes. Yeah.
It's not. There's a huge gap in Greek history.
Uh-huh. Okay.
And we find the Ionians, they make it as far west because they're all pushing west. They're always looking for arable land, right?
Right.
And the Ionians made it as far west as Marseille.
So they could have been Jews.
well, right. The Ionians made it as far west as Marseille, but the Carthaginians still had strong alliances to the Phoenicians of Tyre all the way through the Persian period.
Mm-hmm.
And that can be demonstrated in history.
Okay.
And they had the Western Mediterranean sewed up.
Yeah.
The Greeks
did
not travel there. They didn't travel there because if they did, they risked becoming the slaves of Carthaginian pirates. And they were going to be taken.
Yes. Okay. Very good. Very good. Okay, so this man-God situation is the main theme of chapter 28. We may not even get to verse 14. Let's see here. Behold, you are wiser than Daniel. There is no secret that they can hide from you. Okay, so here, let's bring up the main issue here right away because I believe that there's a metaphorical, non-physical being addressed here, in addition to these physical kings we're talking about, who have elevated themselves above Yahweh, okay? And so, obviously, if they're doing that, they're imitating Lucifer, okay, who was the first to rebel. And that's how many people have interpreted this chapter.
Well, I understand that, and I understand that's how Swift interpreted it. I understand
that's
how Comperé interpreted it. But I think that even though this king is a type of Satan.
Right.
Okay?
We all
make ourselves
Understood.
Adversarial to God when we want to be our own God and make our own rules.
Right.
Okay? And being adversarial to God, boil that down and you're being a Satan.
Right.
That Satan means an adversary, right?
Right.
But this, if we skip ahead to verse 10, thou shalt die the death of the uncircumcised by the hand of strangers. And I believe that indicates that this prince of Tyre must have been one of the circumcised.
Okay.
Dying the death of the uncircumcised is an insult, a slap in the face.
Right.
It's a debasement. So this prince of Tyre was a circumcised man who is exalted. You know, he's a great king. And look at the beauty of Solomon, and Tyre must have been very close behind, right?
Yes.
What we see, the kings of Tyre in the accounts of Kings and Chronicles are every bit the peers of Solomon and David,
right,
and are treated like that.
Yeah, and Solomon, Hiram, king of Tyre, did much of the construction of Solomon's temple. So
right.
A very close relationship between those two men.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And this is we're departed long, 500 years here from Hiram,
yeah,
or 400 at least. But this man had to be a circumcised man for this verse 10 to work.
Right, right. Yeah, for verse 10 to work, right. Let me read verse 3. Behold, you are wiser than Daniel. There is no secret that they can hide from you. If we're talking about a literal person in this verse, Daniel has to be considered the greatest and most specific prophet of them all. His prophecy
came through
to the
letter. What we've seen that Daniel was a contemporary in Ezekiel when I explained the chronology at the beginning of this book, right?
Okay.
And
yeah.
Daniel must have already been famed amongst the Babylonians by the time Ezekiel began writing.
Okay. All right. So he's being compared with Daniel here. Verse 4, with your wisdom and with your understanding, you have gotten your riches and have gotten gold and silver into your treasures. Obviously, this is strictly mercantile stuff here in verse 4. Verse 5, by your great wisdom and by your traffic. What's the Septuagint or traffic, trafficker in either the Hebrew or the
Greek?
Well,
this word traffic is not Canaan, right? It's
right.
Not Canaanite.
Okay.
It's reculo, which is merchandise, traffic, or trade.
Okay, reculo. Okay. Have you increased your riches and your heart is lifted up because of your riches? Obviously, very wealthy people begin to think that they're superior to the rest of us. Verse 6, therefore, thus says Yahweh Elohim, because you have set your heart as the heart of God, behold, therefore, I will bring strangers upon you, the terrible of the nations, and they shall draw their swords against the beauty of your wisdom, and they shall defile your brightness. So in general, Yahweh is saying here through Ezekiel, anybody who attempts to elevate himself equal to God or above God will be brought down by people of his own choosing.
Well, look at how fast Caesar was brought down when he set up a statue to the invincible God.
Right. Yes. Verse 8, they shall bring you down to the pit, and you shall die the deaths of them that are slain in the midst of the seas. Of course, many Phoenician sailors. Tyrian sailors that died in the seas, verse 9.
I would love to drain the Mediterranean and pick up the Phoenician artifacts from the bottom.
Right.
What we could learn from that.
That's right. Verse 9, will you yet say before him that slays you, I am God, but you shall be a man and no God in the hand of him that slays you. You shall die the death of the uncircumcised, so meaning that he's speaking to Israelites who have been circumcised by the hand of strangers, for I have spoken it, says Yahweh Elohim. Moreover, the word of Yahweh came to me, saying, son of man, take up a lamentation upon the king of Tyrus, and say to him, thus says Yahweh Elohim, you seal up the sum full of wisdom and perfect in beauty. You have been in Eden, the garden of God. Okay, so here, let's just get into it right now. There's not time to actually quote the article by Comparé, but Comparé and many others have interpreted this in verse 13 to being not a metaphorical reference back to the whoever Nahash was in the Garden of Eden.
Well, I understand why they would want to do that.
Right.
They want to make this king of Tyre out to be Satan. But I think that this king of Tyre is the same as the prince of Tyre of the first 11 verses.
Okay.
Okay. It's a continuation of the same oracle. They have the same attributes, merchandise, riches, beauty, and wisdom.
Right.
And therefore, I believe that both of these oracles are directed, the one from up until verse 10 and this one beginning at verse 11,
yes,
are directed at the same person. In one, he's called a ruler, and in the other, he's called a king.
Yes.
Okay, it is a different Hebrew word.
Yeah.
But they're synonyms, and that they're directed towards the same person, probably towards the kingship of Tyre as an entity also, whoever's sitting on that throne at any given time in this period, having been guilty of all these things.
Right, right.
As for the Garden of God, the Garden of God is a metaphor
okay.
for the Adamic race as a whole. We see it described in Ezekiel chapter 31, and we'll see that maybe
okay.
next week or the week after, right?
Right.
In times contemporary to Ezekiel and not in times contemporary to Adam and Eve.
Okay.
Because in Ezekiel chapter 31, it basically says that the Assyrian was the tallest cedar in the garden.
Right.
In the Garden of God. It's the same exact
Adamkind.
Phrase.
Okay.
And the Garden of God is our race.
Yes.
We are what he planted back there in Genesis.
Right.
Okay. In Revelation chapter 22, although the phrase Garden of God does not appear there explicitly, it's a very poetic picture of a garden is drawn with the tree bearing 12 manners of fruits,
right.
which can only describe the 12 tribes of Israel.
Exactly.
And that's also how I would perceive the phrase Garden of God
uh-huh.
in Genesis chapters 2 and 3,
yeah.
where Yahweh planted our race as a Garden of God and where it's called the Tree of Life, as opposed to that Tree of Knowledge of Good and Evil.
Yeah.
But this man, he is a member of the Tree of Life. He is one of those of the Garden of God. And he's being called that in Ezekiel's time because we can't assume that the Assyrians of Ezekiel chapter 31 were also in the Garden of Eden.
Yes.
They weren't. They didn't exist until Asher was born. Asher was the son of Shem, Genesis chapter 10. That's who the Assyrians were descended from.
Right, right. Yes.
So that phrase, Garden of God, we have a Garden of God today,
okay.
except it has a lot of weeds in it.
Right, right.
Wherever our race is, that is the Garden of God.
Yeah. And as we're discussing, the king of Tyre at this time was fairly evidently an Israelite, and so he was a member of that garden. And, of course, the tree metaphor, and every tree that the Father has not planted will be hewn down, right?
Well,
we're not
right.
talking about literal trees there.
Over
we're talking
over
about
here.
Races.
So, yeah. so here, this is language reminiscent of Genesis chapter 1.
Right.
But it's language that's being used poetically of a man who lives in Ezekiel's time. That's
yeah.
the way I see this.
Okay.
And we'll see that this person also, before we finish this chapter,
yeah.
Probably next week, that this person is also only a man.
Okay, okay. Let me just start over in verse 13. You have been in the garden of God. Every precious stone was your covering or adornment. The sardius, the topaz, the diamond, the beryl, the onyx, and the jasper, the sapphire, the emerald, and the carbuncle, which is what? Carbuncle is not considered a gem anymore. It's it's kind of like a...
Oh, right, carbuncle.
Yeah.
It's those shells on the bottom of ships.
Yes, yeah, right. So in other words, decorated
with
shells.
It's that crusty buildup on the
right,
bottom of
the ship.
I don't think that's... Carbuncle is barakath. It's a gem or precious stone,
okay.
perhaps an emerald. Let me say that a lot of these Hebrew words, that they really can't be identified with absolute certainty.
Right, right, right. And gold, the workmanship of your tabrets, tambourines, okay, or your musical instruments, and of your pipes, was prepared in you in the day that you were created. Of course, we're still talking, these are very literal things about the kingdom of Tyre and cannot really be associated with the Garden of Eden.
And the tambourine.
Yeah. So let me just read.
And that stuff wasn't invented until Cain. No,
right.
I'm only kidding. I'm only kidding. But, if we wanted to split hairs,
right.
I could say that. Right?
Yes. Okay, now verse 14, you are the anointed cherub that covers, and I have set you so. You were upon the holy mountain of God.
Now, the holy mountain of God is only a reference to the children of Israel, right?
Right.
That's not
Zion.
The Garden of Eden.
True Zion, the government, the mount, the government of true Israel.
That
Zion.
Was never used of our race before Jacob, far as I can see.
Okay. You have walked up and down in the midst of the stones of fire. Let me just read these in verse 15. You were perfect in your ways from the day that you were created till iniquity was found in you. And this verse is... Many, many people have interpreted this as being a reference to Lucifer being up in heaven with Yahweh or Satan.
Well, well, that's nice, but it falls apart in the next verse.
Okay, let me read the next verse. By the multitude of your merchandise, they have filled the midst of you with violence, and you have sinned.
Now, right there, this verse admits that sin came because of they, okay? They have filled the multitude of you in the midst of you with violence by the multitude of your merchandise, okay?
Uh-huh.
This verse admits that sin came because of certain others who were around this king of Tyre, and they caused him to sin. Therefore, this verse cannot accurately describe a single personal satanic spirit being as the author of the great and primary rebellion against Yahweh.
Right,
as Swift interprets it, this verse crumbles that interpretation.
Well, there's certainly a relationship because the critter that was in the Garden of Eden was one of these rebellious ones allied with Lucifer.
Well, there's no doubt that there's a rebellious race on the planet that's adverse to our race. But I wouldn't use this I wouldn't point here and say this is one of them because that can't be done. It falls apart.
Right.
This is actually Satan himself. It falls apart on this verse, and it falls apart on the verse 10, as we discussed in the first part.
Yeah,
of the part.
I would agree that any relationship to Satan's rebellion in heaven is metaphorical and not literal, as these verses are read. Okay, but what do you make of this phrase, "O covering cherub"? And then we really don't have time to get. We can maybe start next week with Comparé's analysis of these verses.
Well, we had cherubs protecting the Garden of God, right?
Right.
When Adam was cast out from it.
Okay, and also...
That's a metaphor, right?
Right.
And here we have a man set as king over the Garden of God, and he is metaphorically equated to that cherub. He says, Yahweh says that, I have set thee as the anointed cherub.
Okay.
Now, Yahweh did not set Satan over the children of
right,
Israel.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah.
So there again, the Swift story falls apart.
Okay. And also the cherub, the two cherubs on the Ark of the Covenant, were set in place by Yahweh, right? And they didn't rebel. So we're talking about certainly these three verses, verses 13 through 16, are talking about the literal king of Tyre. Okay. And metaphorically, all people who elevate themselves above Yahweh
are Satan, right?
Yes.
Even if they're Adamites,
right?
Even if they're anointed kings anointed by Yahweh,
yeah.
Which this king certainly was,
right? And so there's no doubt that this interpretation is accurate and cannot be refuted. So and since there's really no time left, I'd still like to discuss Bertrand Comparé's.
Well, we could get into this next week.
Yeah, we'll get into it next week.
We'll finish this chapter next
week.
And then,
we'll see if there's any merit to his interpretation. And many others. He's not the only one. Probably hundreds of people have interpreted these verses as being a direct reference to the Garden of Eden at Nachash, Satan rebelling against Yahweh in heaven, being cast down to earth, and then appearing in the Garden of Eden as the seducer of Eve. Okay? Which metaphorically, you can interpret some of these verses that way, but as you point out, not all of them. The very literal verses cannot be interpreted that way. Okay, so we'll get into more
detail.
Well,
I see the same pattern going on.
Uh huh.
Yeah, that the original angels that fell, the fallen angels. They wanted to make a creation of their own.
That's right.
And that would be adversarial to Yahweh.
That's right.
So their offspring are bastards. And because they are created in violation of Yahweh's law, they are adversarial, meaning that they are Satan.
That's right.
If you're a bastard, you are Satan.
That's right.
Okay? There's 6 billion people in the world. I'd say 5.5 billion of them are Satan.
Right, or bastards. That's right.
That's the way I look at it.
Okay.
If your existence is created contrary to Yahweh's law, you're a Satan.
Yes, yes. Okay. So I think there's about 2 or 3 pages in this essay entitled Merchants of Babylon by Bertrand Comparé, where he sets forth this metaphorical premise. Okay, so let's start next time.
Well, right, I would say that the pattern is the same.
Yes, oh, sure.
But that's not what this is talking about. This is talking about the King of Tyre.
Yes, yeah, and then but there's similarities both in the rebellion in heaven and, of course, the current Babylonian merchant system we have in existence in the world today. People in the world, especially Judeo-Christians, are worshiping the rulers of this Babylonian merchant system as if they were God.
Well, what's the result of the Babylonian merchant system? I'll tell you what the result is. The Jews want to create man in their image.
That's right.
That's satanic.
They want to enslave us.
The Jews want to reinvent. Look at all the genetic engineering going on.
Yeah.
Look at all the hybridization going
on. It's all happening again.
It's all happening, right.
Yeah.
And therefore we understand the nature of sin.
Yes, yes, yeah. And the genetic manipulation. You know, Jesus said, it shall be as in the days of Noah, when all that genetic manipulation and hybridization was going on. Exactly, exactly. Of course, the mainstream Christians don't understand that that's what was going on. And that's why he had to destroy that area of the world where that was happening. Okay. All right, so, yeah, let's get into this in greater depth next week on Christogenos. And tomorrow we're going to be continuing our series on...
our slow walk through the epistles of Peter.
Right.
That's okay. It's
very, very slow. And then on Sunday, I've had to change plans for Sunday. I just wasn't able to set up an interview with this pastor who is very much... a supporter of Paul as a Nomian, and maybe we can do it. Unfortunately, he's not based in America, and the overseas connection is not going to work. I've had difficulty with several callers who are not based in America. Anyway, the replacement is going to be Greg Howard. This Sunday, we're going to be talking about the definitions of the word fornication and proof positive that one of the definitions of fornication is race mixing, okay? That's going to be our discussion this Sunday on Voice of Christian Israel, okay? So thank you all. Bill, thank you for joining me again tonight. It's a pleasure, as always. Thank you all for listening, and even to the lurkers. Maybe those lurkers learned something today. I doubt it, though. All right. Thank you all for listening. Praise Yahweh.
Praise Yahweh.
Okay, Yahweh bless everybody. Good night.